Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, May 13, 2016, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss the investigation of ExxonMobil and Competitive Enterprise Institute and others. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome three experts to our call today. We're going to have opening remarks from each in turn. We'll hear first from Attorney General Scott Pruitt. He's the Attorney General of Oklahoma. He'll be followed by Georgetown Law School Visiting Professor John Baker. And then finally, we'll hear from Boyden Gray of Boyden Gray Associates right here in Washington, D.C. Note at the outset that Attorney General Scott Pruitt is in the midst of mediation, so he's going to be with us only briefly, I think long enough to set the table and then give us his thoughts on what's transpiring here. With that, Attorney General Pruitt, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Well, it's very kind of you for the opportunity, and thank you for the time this afternoon. And I am going to just share a few comments up front with respect to this issue around the President Obama's energy agenda, and specifically this issue involving Exxon and related companies. But for those of you who may not be aware, in late March, there was a handful of East Coast state attorneys general joined by Vice President Al Gore, along with the New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and they announced what they called an unprecedented coalition that, quote, vows to defend climate change progress made under the president. And as such, they announced a criminal investigation with respect of energy companies that and their position of disputing the science behind global warming. And so this coalition of 20 or so states are using their investigatory authority to investigate fraud to target certain energy companies in this country with respect to their position around a very important public policy issue of climate change. And so several of the attorneys general, myself and General Strange from Alabama and others, responded obviously in a concerned way that our colleagues' investigation undermined the trust that people have placed in attorneys general to investigate fraud. And the investigatory subpoenas that were issued both to companies like Exxon, but also nonprofit companies that were involved in think tank type of analysis with respect to the climate change issue. And I just wanted a couple of things with respect to the concern that we have offered in this process. First, the fraud investigation targets only fossil fuel companies and only statements that minimize climate change risk. You know, if it's possible to minimize the risk of climate change, then the same goes for exaggeration. If minimization is fraud, then exaggeration is fraud. And these attorneys general just simply engage in only fossil fuel companies they believe have offered statements of minimizing climate change risk. It would seem to me that they would be as concerned about those entities that perhaps have maximized or exaggerated fraud as well. Secondly, the attorneys general have taken the unusual step of, as I indicated, aligning themselves with competitors in their investigative targets. They have titled themselves the Attorneys General United for Clean Power. I mean, and they have openly and unapologetically identified the tobacco litigation of the 1990s as their example on how they are going to work together to investigate the statements offered by Exxon and to determine what kind of fraud has been perpetrated upon consumers with an eye toward potentially massive amounts of money that they would seek in damages. In fact, there is, just a sidebar comment, there is information in the marketplace. There's been some FOIA requests made of certain attorneys general that are part of the coalition where there is email exchanges with certain Green Coalition C3s and otherwise where it is discussed rather extensively how this could be a huge money source for the states that are part of the coalition. So that is a concern secondarily. And then thirdly, the investigation, and I think that Boyden is going to spend some time unpacking this from a free speech perspective, but it inescapably implicates a public policy debate and raises substantial First Amendment concerns. We all know in this call, and our colleagues know this as well, that there's a vigorous debate that exists in this country regarding the risk of climate change and the appropriate response to those risks. And that is very much a public policy evaluation by Congress and others. And these group of attorneys general have sought to use their investigatory power and their criminal enforcement power to basically condemn that public policy debate that's ongoing by those in the marketplace. So this is a rather significant issue that I think has been discussed for some time. It's actually Senator Whitehouse, the U.S. Senator from Rhode Island, I think has worked in conjunction with the Vice President Al Gore and this group of attorneys general with a very strategic approach to try to leverage the industry and leverage companies with respect to their public policy advocacy around climate change and hold them accountable from a fraud perspective. Now, there's a little bit the Attorney General of New York has a little bit different angle than the subpoenas that have been issued by the Attorney General in the Virgin Islands because he has a securities component to his inquiry because he's saying that the shareholders and investors have been defrauded of information that would be necessary in their decision making on securities. And so, as you all know, he's got very wide authority under the laws in New York. And so I think he's kind of taking a different approach than the rest of the 19. But nonetheless, they are committed in this coalition and using their investigative power to try to put Exxon in the defensive posture with respect to fraud. And unfortunately, as I indicated at the first, it's not just Exxon. It is also nonprofits that are engaged in the debate as well. I think the Competitive Enterprise Institute, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Professor or Boyden, I think that's the other entity that has been targeted by the coalition. And so we have spoken out as a collection of attorneys general saying that we're not going to be a part of this coalition and have challenged our colleagues' view of their investigatory power and that we're proud to be a part of a different coalition, you know, one that's driven by a respect for rule of law rather than an ambition to use the law to silence voices with which we disagree. And so the coalition of 29 states that we're a part of is a part of the challenge to the Clean Power Plan, and there's ongoing litigation that we're a part of in that regard. And this is not about trying to pick winners and losers in the energy sector in order to silence those with whom we disagree. It's rather to ensure that the EPA is acting consistent with the power granted to it by Congress. And that is something that coalition of 29 attorneys general are focused upon, which is quite a bit different than using the authority of the office in the way that the Green 20 has chosen to do. So with that, I'll yield the floor to the professor and thank you for the opportunity to be a part of the discussion today.
Thank you, General. This investigation is so preposterous that it's amazing that we have to pay any attention to it. And the only reason we do is because the media is promoting it and not shouting it down as any sensible person would. I'm just going to go through a number of the elements. The general mentioned the broad powers of the Attorney General in New York. It's called the Martin Act. It's 24,000 words. It's their version of the blue sky laws, which were enacted before the 33 Securities Acts. It not only gives the AG tremendous broad investigative authority, it links civil and criminal fraud, doesn't really make much of a distinction. There's no mental element required, and what act are required is very, very thin. It was really enacted before the 33's Act in order to govern the issuance of stock and to avoid fraud in the issuance and misrepresentation. There's one tiny section out of that 24,000 words that you might say is just goes to general misrepresentation, and that has to be the section that they're focused on. All of this started because an outfit called Climate News and then the LA Times and then in conjunction with Columbia School of Journalism did quote a report. And of course, they went into great detail and in their investigation, and news media is accepting what they've said because supposedly Climate News is a distinguished journal because it got a Pulitzer Prize. Anyway, it's been repeated and repeated over in the blogs, and the other side is fairly thinly represented. Either that or Google has somehow tweaked the SEO operation. That was bad enough, but then on March 29th, as the general referred to, there's this press conference, and it's an unbelievable press conference because at the end of it, Schneiderman, the AG of New York, says, you know, our ultimate purpose here is to save the planet. And, you know, I don't know when prosecutors thought that they could use a criminal indictment to save the planet. It just really goes beyond belief. But having Al Gore there, Al Gore, as the general alluded to, has a conflict of interest. I mean, he stands to make money in all this. And the guy who was most vociferous in talking about fraud and accusing the fossil fuel companies of fraud was Gore, over and over again. And then Schneiderman gets on and says, we haven't prejudged this. And he goes on to say, we're going to look at it very seriously. But it was a joke. I mean, the whole thing was unbelievable. Boyden's going to talk about the First Amendment issue. I'll pass on that, other than to say that if Scalia's replacement isn't a Republican appointee, they're going to have to find another defense, because we know that Gore and others have been very strongly campaigning against Citizens United. The fraud issue has been taken apart by Professor John Coffey, a noted securities expert at Columbia. Coffey never is one to want to come down and side with one side or the other. But you read what he wrote, and you know that he dissects it as there's no case here. He goes through and he carefully looks at it and points out that even under the Supreme Court's relatively recent Omnicare case, that this is opinion, and even if somehow you could construe anything in here as involving material fact, it's still not going to fly. And the other point he makes is that the donation business simply is not a basis for going after them, because it's not covered by the statute and it's not covered by securities laws. So I also add, who on a jury, because this will never go to a jury, who on a jury would ever say that they were defrauded? Remember, this is fraud on the public and public investors, supposedly. What's the fraud? That they didn't do what Schneiderman thinks they should have done, and which would have resulted in lower stock prices and higher gas prices than what we had. I don't think that members of the jury are going to feel that they were defrauded. The tobacco analogy, which the general mentioned, Coffey says, I worked for some of the plaintiffs in the tobacco cases, and there's no analogy between this and that, because those people had been victimized, they had been addicted. I also go on a piece in Fox, and I'll cut it short here, about how this is not just a coalition, as the general refers to. This is really, I think, arguably a violation of the Compact Clause. And the reason is, while the Supreme Court has allowed many compacts, or has not overseen compacts, because they think that many of them can be entered into without the consent of Congress, as the text of the Constitution says, their one caveat is, as long as it does not threaten federal power. Well, in this case, the whole rationale by Schneiderman has been repeated over and over again. We're doing this because the federal government won't do it. If there's a violation of the Compact Clause, this would seem to be the clearest one out there. Thank you. I'll stop now and turn it over to Boyden.
Okay. Well, that all that's good preview for what I would say, which is that leave aside for a minute the money angle of this. What's going on is part of a very concerted effort by supporters of renewable energy and other interests that benefit from certain policies to the disadvantage of other producers, say, of energy. What's happening is an effort to squelch all dissenting views about the orthodoxy of climate control. The federal government has put literally tens of billions of dollars, our federal government, into supporting an infrastructure of research, and I would also say PR, some might even go so far as to say propaganda, to propagate a theory that has not yet is not yet cleared the kind of scientific hurdles that you would normally expect for an action of such a provocative nature. There is still enormous debate about the pace of climate change. The climate's always been changing, but the pace of warming of the Earth, that's under huge debate. The models, for example, do not match up with the real measurements. That's a real question right there. If you can't model the present, if you can't predict the present, if your models don't conform to the present, how can they possibly predict the future? And the result of all these actions and things of this nature is to do as much as you can to scare people into falling into line about what you want, what behavior you want out of the public in the United States. I might not be so nervous about the First Amendment aspects of this if this were limited, say, just to this case. But unfortunately, there is a lot of evidence of this kind of conduct occurring in other areas of the economy. And for example, in the field of financial regulation, very hard to find anybody to seek judicial review, which is guaranteed by the First Amendment. It's an absolute right to petition the government for redress of grievances. Has been part of the landscape of administrative law, of rule of law, for a century or two. But today, agencies are ready to express retaliation against any regulated entity underneath their control, to blackmail them, to threaten them with retaliation if they seek to have courts review what they've done. And this is going on across the government. And it's a very disturbing development. This is more provocative than much of what you see, but I believe that it is related to the timing, everything, to a very big case now pending in the courts. The leading climate change action being taken by the federal government, it's being appealed across the board, and one gets by a number of states, among other parties, and one gets the clear impression that part of this effort is to retaliate for the temerity of the people who are challenging this action in the courts, for the temerity of doing just that, which is an exercise of guaranteed First Amendment free speech rights. Many companies, public companies, cannot afford to be in the limelight of alleged criminal investigation, however it might be misreported by the mainstream media. But many companies simply do not want to live in that kind of controversy. It's not good for sales. It's not good for stockholders. It's just not a, it's not a, it's not something that they, controversy they would just as soon not engage in. They're not looking for it, but they certainly don't want to invite it. And this kind of case is a generator of potentially misleading publicity, which no ordinary person wants. And push comes to shove, all other things being equal, that person would say, "Oh, I would, gee whiz, I'll just hope for better luck next time." And pretty soon you're on a slippery slope, and you can't question anything government does. I would just end my little part of this by using an example I've used before of Galileo, for those who know anything about the science of astronomy at all. But Galileo, early on in the time that he lived back in the Middle Ages, living in Venice, took issue with the orthodoxy of the Catholic Church, which held that the sun revolved around the earth, and he didn't believe that was the case and began to theorize that it was the other way around, and he had several inventions of microscopes and telescopes that helped him see a little bit better than what most people could observe. And he leaves, a big mistake, leaves Venice and goes to Florence thinking he will be able to make more money there, or thinking the grass will be greener there, and finds himself in the orbit of the Catholic Church. They torment him. They actually torture him. I don't know whether they waterboarded him, but he confessed error, that in fact, no, the sun really does revolve around the earth. And that, of course, is about as big a mistake as you can make in science. And that became the orthodox view of the Catholic Church for over 300 years, not corrected until about 50, 60 years ago. It didn't end well for the Catholic Church. It was a big, big problem for them. It didn't end well for Galileo. It didn't end well for scientific inquiry. And one sort of senses a repeat of that here. You either put up, or you either go along, or you're going to get a big dose of inquisition with all the potential torture that goes with it. Now, the torture that goes on in Washington is not physical; it's mental, but it's still pretty rugged in any event, and that's not the way the government should be. Or governments should be operating. They should be encouraging, or at least not squelching, questions about third-party review, independent review of actions that they're taking. So, thank you for the time.
Very good. I want to go back to Attorney General Pruitt, if he's still online, and Professor John Baker, and give them a chance to add to their comments if they'd like. Before we do that, I want to open the floor to questions so people can begin queuing up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll get to you. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who joins with a question. Let me go back to General Pruitt if he's still on the line. Anything to add or modify to your opening remarks, General?
No, sir, and just look forward to questions.
Okay. John Baker, anything to for you to add?
Yeah, I think the point that Boyden makes about public corporations is really very important. And I would extend it and say that essentially public corporations had been extorted, intimidated, et cetera, to become a vehicle for the left, because people on the right believe that making a profit is what corporations are supposed to do, but people on the left don't believe that. So essentially they put up demands And for management, when they're looking at it, they're not going to fight it for all the reasons that Boyden said. In this case, Exxon has no choice. They've got to fight it. But when that happens, in order to continue to make money and avoid bad publicity, which they justify in terms of making the bottom line better than it would otherwise be, they become the drivers of left-wing ideology. And somehow we've got to figure out how to expose that and how to counter it.
Very good. Well, we've got three questions on the line so far. With that, let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is Robin Bravender at Greenwire. I just wanted to clarify something that Mr. Gray said about the retaliation effect of this Exxon action. Did you mean to say that the Clean Power Plan litigation has sparked this as retaliation, or were you talking about climate lawsuits more broadly? Can you clarify that?
No, I'm not sure I understand your question. What I said about that some of this may be in response to the challenges made to the Clean Power Plan by the various plaintiffs or appellants.
So you're saying that the states are bringing the Exxon, starting the Exxon investigations in retaliation for the Clean Power Plan litigation?
Yeah, I think the timing is, you have to look at the timing. I mean, is it completely coincidental? I don't know. But, coincidences don't occur like this. I think they're, and I can give you other examples, if you'd like, outside of this field, that show a similar pattern. And
you think they're retaliating against opponents of the Clean Power Plan broadly, or I don't believe Exxon's involved in that?
Well, I don't know. Exxon's not the only target here. They've got plenty of nonprofits that are going. I mean, the Competitive Enterprise Institute is dealing with a humongous subpoena that covers, I don't know, 20 years. Of documentation. It's going to be very expensive for them to comply with it. So I think they've sought to quash it as being unauthorized for reasons that General Pruitt went into in the beginning. But there are a lot of people who are being who have contributed to raising questions about the common sense of the government policy, and the beneficiaries are often what some economists refer to as rent seekers. That is, clean power interests who have huge government subsidies stand to gain, as I believe Vice President Gore has personally, stand to gain from policies that feed off of the kind of disrepute that is being sought in this set of subpoenas and actions.
Okay, thanks.
Can I add to that? If everything Schneiderman says is true, there's still no fraud. Coffee makes. All you have to do is read the Coffee article, and you know there's no case here. They are trying to create law where none exists. Now, if they can get something passed and change the law, that's different, and we can have a fight over it. But to go out and use a criminal investigation against something where there's clearly no violation of the law, that is abuse of power as big as anything you can imagine. There are violations. I mean, in terms of the ABA ethics, that is not just the conflict of interest question, but you've got the issue here that Schneiderman allowed Gore to go on and on the way he did and was not at all regulated by Schneiderman, and he was making totally irresponsible statements. And to have somebody like that at the press conference where you're talking about possibly indicting his economic competitors, that's just outrageous.
And Professor, you or Boyden may have already referred to this, but if you did, forgive me. I was in and out on your all's presentation, but there, I think there's actually been a 1983 action filed by Exxon against the Attorney General of the Virgin Islands, if I'm not mistaken. And so I think it goes to what you just described as far as the abuse of authority and abuse of power.
I'm glad they filed that.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. We still have three questions pending, and we'll get to the next question momentarily. Let me ask a question about the subpoena. It has been mentioned a subpoena against CEI and a subpoena of Exxon. My understanding of the subpoena of Exxon is it goes back to 1977, so covers five different decades, almost 40 years worth of information, at communications with almost 90 groups and dozens of individuals. Can any of you speak to the breadth of that subpoena and whether that's fairly typical in terms of its breadth and scope?
Well, I think from my perspective, in my office, as far as investigative subpoenas that we issue, CID authority that we exercise, that would be entirely unusual to have that type of time period that you would go back. I mean, it is breathtaking in its length of time, but also the depth by which it's seeking information. So it is truly a fishing expedition, and I think it's more than that. I think it's intimidation. I think it's coercion. I think it's really trying to use the power of the state to truly silence dissenting views. And the science over time obviously has, you know, there's been different discoveries and interpretations of the science and modeling and the rest that demonstrate certain things to somehow attribute knowledge to Exxon or to an entity that's engaged in that debate and holding that back, defrauding investors or defrauding the public generally, and try to think that you have a fraud claim around that is, I mean, it truly is quite astounding that this group of attorneys general have stood together and used the power of their office to communicate that to the public, and that they're going to use their authority in that way. I mean, my view, they all should be subject to a 1983 type of response by the entities that have been targeted, because make no mistake about it, they've been targeted.
And for some people in our audience, could you just describe what a 1983 action is, General Pruitt?
What's a constitutional tort? I mean, it's in this instance, all the discussion that Boyden had with respect to the free speech provisions, it is truly using color of law authority that is vested in a public official to deny or impact someone's constitutional liberties or freedom.
All right. Still three questions left from our audience, so let's take another call from our audience now.
Dean, this is Jerry Lozier from Winston & Strawn, and my question may have been answered by Boyden and the professor. My question had been whether the targets were going to resist or comply with the subpoenas, and it sounds like they're going to resist. God bless them.
Anybody want to comment or comment further on that?
Well, CEI has filed a motion to quash, and we'll see what happens.
I think Exxon is actually seeking to comply as best they can, but they filed the 1983 action as an offensive posture as well. So I think they've done both of those things, to the best of my knowledge. And gentlemen, I'm going to have to jump off. I apologize, but I am being held back into the mediation here with the federal judge, and I apologize for that, but it's been a joy to be with you, and forgive me for having to jump off early.
Thank you for joining the call, General. It's good to have you. Still two questions remaining. If you'd like to join the queue and join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take another question from our audience.
Thank you, gentlemen. This is Randall Smith in Orlando, Florida. My question also went to the extent of the resistance to these subpoenas by the targets, and you partially answered that. There was an op-ed, I believe, earlier this week in the Wall Street Journal that addressed the constitutionality of these non-judicial administrative subpoenas as resting on an early 1950s Supreme Court decision. And I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on that as well. Thank you.
Well, Andrew Grossman is. I've just gotten recently Andrew Grossman of Baker Hotstetler's objections on behalf of the Competitive Enterprise Institute to the subpoenas. It runs about 5 pages, so I haven't read it yet. No more than that.
I think what the article you may be talking about was, I think Hamburger, who's an administrative law expert just in the last 2 or 3 days, raising due process issues in connection with these subpoenas because they were issued without a court approval. They're sort of administrative subpoenas, you might call them, issued by the regulatory agency itself without having to go to a court the way normally a policeman would have to go and get a warrant from a court to search your house or to ask you questions. So that, I think, is the issue he's raising in his op-ed. And I have quickly scanned the motion filed by HEI, by CEI, Competitive Enterprise Institute. And I don't know whether they make that due process argument, but it is clearly an issue that needs to be addressed not just in this context but across the government. That is the practice of the last several decades of allowing more and more subpoenas to be issued without the independent third party review of a court.
Once again, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to join the conversation. We've got 2 questions pending, I understand, so let's take another call now.
Yeah, hi, this is Nathan in Los Angeles, and my question is, it seems to me that the left has sort of really gone crazy on a couple of things that really used to be, I think, core principles for them. You know, I think this case raises at least 3 of them that I could think of. And one used to be, you know, the principle of free speech, where I think the left really in the 60s and 70s really took that very seriously and defended all types of speech, whether it's, you know, Nazis marching in a parade or really anything. You know, the second is sort of criminal due process and not overreaching and so on and so forth. The third is sort of scientific inquiry, where you know, this really seems like Galileo and the church. And I think the left, you really used to take all 3 of those things very seriously. And I wonder, when the 2 of you speak to more serious people on the left, what do they make of this? I mean, do they think that this is really crazy as well, or how do they deal with the cognitive dissonance?
Well, I haven't spoken to anybody on the left on this question, but my other conversations with people on the left, as you have on the right, you have some reasonable people and you have some very unreasonable people. And it appears that the unreasonable ones are taking control.
I'll say this, that perhaps I shouldn't admit it, but I do have friends who are more liberal than I am, if you want to use a political analogy, and who are much more aggressively pro-action under a climate umbrella than say I am. I have never in any of these discussions that I've either listened to or even maybe participated in, never heard anybody defend this set of subpoenas as an example of how this issue should be pursued in the United States government. I've heard lots of discussion that's on the merits. You can sit there and debate the merits, but it's on the merits. It's open. It's not coercive. It's not intimidating. It is very open and very much in the mode of what really is going on here. What can we do about it? Are there steps that can be taken to mitigate the damage today, whatever that damage might be, whether it's to the oceans or whatever? And but I've never heard anyone defend this action by this group. So if that, I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but I've never heard anybody defend it.
Yeah, but I would add that Schneiderman would not have gone out on the limb of the other AGs that they didn't think that there was in some quarters some very strong support for what they were doing.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. One thing I find curious, maybe one of our speakers wants to comment on it or pass, it's been pretty widely reported, relatedly, I suppose, that the government entities, the government agencies responsible for cataloging global warming data went back to the 1930s and 40s and changed data. They modified data so that those periods were cooler, and by comparison, the more modern figures are now warmer, relatively speaking. And I imagine there are some very valid reasons possibly for changing the old data, because there are different ways of measuring, different instrumentation, different locations to take measurements, all sorts of reasons you might adjust data one way or the other. But the government scientists involved in changing those figures have refused to disclose their methodology or their reasoning, even to congressional oversight staff and committees. That strikes me as, I don't know, somebody mentioned dissonance before. That gives me a little cognitive dissonance that we have government-paid, government-funded scientists, rather, who won't disclose information, and we have government actors subpoenaing information from private companies. Does that raise any red flags with either of you?
Well, it raises. Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Boyd.
Of course, it raises red flags. And that flap of several years ago caused quite a stir in scientific circles, because I think people who do take this seriously, if you might call them on the left, I think we're embarrassed by some of the manipulations. We don't know the full extent. I would love to see a breakdown of the, I said so in a piece I've just recently written, a breakdown of all the money the federal government has spent, our government has spent, on climate change. It's really a rather staggering figure, I believe, and how much of it has really been research on answers, which is what I think is needed here, research on how to get certain technologies out in front in an open and fair manner. But how much of that money has not been spent on that, but has been spent on in effect buying the influence of academicians who are happy to take the money to spread a false narrative or a misguided narrative or an incomplete narrative of what the facts are. And what we really do need here is answers, is a set of answers to some very legitimate questions that are being raised. They're going to cost money to be answered, but it's not clear to me that this kind of lawsuit, this kind of subpoena, this kind of harassment is going to do anything to provide an open inquiry into the very open questions.
Dean, it seems to me
here,
people really ought to be worried about the future of the rule of law. I just want to read the end of Coffey's article. Again, Coffey's a very careful guy who doesn't make strong statements. Quote, ultimately, if statutes lose their moorings and become vehicles by which regulators can become knights on horseback, dispensing justice as they see fit, the rule of law is imperiled. That has not happened yet, but stay tuned. Even Coffey understands the dangerous direction that we're moving in.
I understand we have two callers with questions remaining. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now check in with another caller.
Hi, this is Claude Laporte from New York. It struck me a little bit that this was somewhat similar to where Metropolitan Life was brought into the asbestos cases, because they had done some studies, industrial physical studies on people and saw some link here, but then they didn't disclose their findings, or they towed them down for a year, and it ended up, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. And I think perhaps General Boyden, you could expand a little bit. It's not just the chilling of the speech that's involved. It's the chilling of the actual research that goes on as a result of this sort of inquiry.
Well, that's what I was getting at. What you don't know, what would be very useful to find out, is how much of the money that's being spent by the government is being spent to, in effect, purchase echo chamber work from people in academia. And I don't know the answer to that, but when the government spends the kind of money they spend, followed up by this kind of action, which is not directed at the government and what it's doing with this billion, but is aimed at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a nonprofit, which is going to have to raise a lot of money to answer the subpoena if it's not quashed. That's just not happening. It's a very unequal, asymmetrical system.
One would think that with the expertise in these energy companies, you would want them to engage in research as opposed to incentivizing them to stay away from it.
Well, this is going to chill research for sure. It's like, you know, being in the White House and keeping a diary. You don't want to do that with subpoenas that might subpoena your diary. It kind of chills the making of or the retention of history. I once had Kissinger just unload on me once several years ago because he thought I was responsible for stopping people from keeping diary notes because they might be subpoenaed, and I suppose I was. But this is going to happen. People are going to say, all right, let's not engage in any innovation. Let's not engage in any experimentation because we're only going to get zapped for it. And one of the measures, stepping back just a little bit, of the phenomenon that I'm trying to describe of chilling speech, inquiry, review actions, appeals, the court that deals with appeals from regulatory agencies like EPA involved here or any other regulatory agency, the Federal Communications Commission, whatever, Food and Drug Administration. Those appeals are handled by a court in Washington called the D.C. Circuit. It's been in the news a little bit, but not well known nationally. It's considered to be the second most important court because it deals with all these government cases. We're in the midst now of what everybody admits, and I don't think anyone denies, is the greatest explosion of federal regulation probably in the history of America on a proportional basis or any kind of inflation-rated basis. It's an absolute explosion. But the caseload of the D.C. Circuit has been plummeting, and you've got to ask yourself the question, when you have all of this regulation exploding, not just in connection with climate change and this issue we're talking about today, but across the board, financial services, whatever it is, you'd think there'd be more review. Well, there's less, and some judges on the D.C. Circuit are so low in work assignments that they're getting bored and they're running around the country looking for cases in other circuits. And what does that tell you? It tells you that that something's afoot to stop people from trying to seek independent, impartial, appellate review of what's being asked of them or directed of them by the central government.
Professor Baker, anything on this point?
Boyden, what about, will any of those corporations be willing to cooperate in John Doe plaintiffs?
I would think so. Yeah, I think some probably would be. Yeah, but
well, you're going to have to convince them to do it.
That's right. Well, I'll give you one example. again, it's not in this particular area, but I'm involved with the lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the a part of Dodd-Frank, the financial regulation bill that passed after the meltdown, and it deals specifically with the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. And the suit challenging it on constitutional grounds was filed late one Thursday afternoon, or late Thursday evening, as late as you could file, near midnight, electronically. And less than 12 hours later, the little bank that had shown enough courage to allow its name to be used as the plaintiff, a little community bank in Texas, was called by the bank's examiner at the Office of the Control of the Currency, which is in the Treasury Department, with questions. What are you doing? Why didn't you tell us? People upstairs want to know. Who have you been talking to? Who in the media have you been discussing this with? Who's helping you finance this? That's all pretty scary stuff. Less than 12 hours after the lawsuit's been filed. Now, when I first came to Washington, which is long ago than I want to admit, and I worked in the government for 12 years, if my bosses, first Reagan, then Bush, had ever caught me making that kind of threatening phone call, I'd have been fired in less than 24 hours.
I think we have time for a final question, and we have one question pending, so let's go to our final caller of the day here.
This is Manny Klausner calling from Los Angeles, and I work with the Reason Foundation. This has been an excellent presentation. My quick question is, I'm not sure if it was John or Boyden that referred to ExxonMobil's response concerning their subpoena in addition to the 1983 action they filed. And as I understood, the comment was that they're planning to answer or respond as best they can. And I was just wondering if you have any more specifics, if you could amplify, or they find a lot of objections, so they really turned over a lot of documents, you know, with all the organizations that have been named as those who exchanged communications with Exxon Mobil back in 1977. I would hope that they're not trying their best to put the documents together, and they're objecting. Do you have any information about that?
Well, I've looked at the CEI motion, and there making pretty straightforward procedural objections to the subpoena, saying it's not authorized and it does this, it violates First Amendment, et cetera, as was suggested, I guess, by Professor Baker before. It's only it's 5 pages long. It does not disclose a single document. And so I don't think Reason Foundation, I know...
Yeah, but what about ExxonMobil, Gordon?
Well, it's much of the request is for ExxonMobil's communications with CEI, yeah. And
well,
CEI.
Also, no, but Reason, there's a whole slew of organizations that are mentioned in addition to CEI in the ExxonMobil subpoena. That includes Reason Foundation.
That includes Reason,
but,
as far as I've heard. You may know more about that than I do, but Reason is included.
I'll send another email to you on that one.
Okay.
Yeah. but the question is, was it John, was it you that referred to ExxonMobil's attempt to, they're attempting to respond as best they can? Somebody made a comment about it.
No. I'm not in contact with ExxonMobil, so I don't know exactly if it doesn't appear out there publicly. The I think they're putting up more of a fight than typically a public corporation does, and that was the base in this article I've just finished. It makes the point that usually public corporations put up no fight, and they're at least putting up a fight.
I see. Okay. Well, that's helpful.
Good to hear from you, man.
Thank you. You're saying the same.
Thanks for joining the call. gentlemen, we're just about out of time, but we do have a minute or two for a final thought from each of you. John Baker, Professor Baker, a final thought.
Well, there are so many fronts in which the centralization of power is going on that all I can say is that the most effective force here really have been other state attorneys general, really led by General Pruitt, that are pushing back against the coalition that was described in New York. But this whole thing where you have the country divided, groups of states against other groups of states, and the whole thing is not being processed, as Boyd suggested should be, through the constitutional procedures set up through the Congress and through the federal courts, and instead states are taking this on. That's not a good sign for the Republic.
Final thought from Boyden Gray, Ambassador.
Well, to all those who may have tuned in, your questions, your doubts, your views matter when you're talking to your congressman, when you're talking to your local reporter, when you're talking to your local law school friends or academic friends. This is a cultural thing. Maybe at bottom, it's cultural, at least partially cultural, and so it becomes, in effect, the responsibility of every literate citizen.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you both, and I also, in his absence, thank Attorney General Scott Pruitt of Oklahoma. This has been a very, very interesting call. I appreciate your time. I don't think we've heard the last of this, so we will probably invite you back for a future teleforum call on related topics. To our audience, thank you for joining as well, and thank you for your questions. A reminder to check the Federal Society's website and the teleforum calendar for upcoming calls. Monitor your emails as well. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.